Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Mr. Churchill in the White House, the untold story of a prime minister and two presidents, by Robert Schmuel, narrated by Paul Bamer. No lover ever studied every whim of his mistress as I did those of President Roosevelt. Winston Churchill, to his private secretary, John Colville, May 2, 1948. All goes well, and the President, Dwight D. Eisenhower, is a real friend. Winston Churchill to Clementine Churchill, May 5, 1959. Prologue. A devoted fisherman, Winston Churchill never stopped angling, not even at the White House, though much of his time in Washington, D.C. was spent conferring with presidents, first Franklin D. Roosevelt and later Dwight D. Eisenhower, about grave matters of war and peace. The prime minister's visits were nevertheless spirited, at times entertaining occasions, themselves worthy of a multi-part historical docudrama. Whether in residence at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue itself, or the various presidential retreats outside D.C., Churchill was exceptionally adept at making himself at home. When obliged to be attired, this son of an American mother and an English father shuffled about in velvet slippers and a tailored-for-air raids siren suit resembling a romper. With a cigar nearly always in hand, he prowled these corridors of power in the hopes of strengthening his own. Both Roosevelt and Eisenhower eventually adjusted to the unconventional habits and hours of their guest, who not only proposed these visits but almost always, by accident or design, stayed longer than initially intended. Despite a veritable and growing mountain of Churchilliana, no book thus far has been exclusively devoted to the British Prime Minister's frequent, often furtive visits to Washington, particularly during World War II, and to telling why these sojourns were so historically meaningful. Considered from today's perspective, these trips clearly take on a level of profound diplomatic and military significance, revealing just how influential a foreign leader can become in steering American foreign policy, especially during wartime. In each of his two terms, Churchill trolled the Capitol with his ideas and viewpoints in hopes of luring presidents to initiate joint activities involving the United Kingdom and the United States. This is one reason his visits lasted as long as they did, gaining acceptance for his endless suggestions and proposals simply took time. While this book confines itself to Churchill's premierships in the 1940s and 1950s, it's worth contrasting his sway with that of other international leaders and pointing out how unprecedented his access to American leaders proved to be. Imagine the current UK Prime Minister, French President, German Chancellor, or anyone else in a position of power abroad settling into a suite in the residential quarters of the White House and having the liberty of talking with the President throughout the day or night. Or imagine Ukraine's President, Volodymyr Zelensky, frequently compared to Churchill, spending weeks at America's most famous address discussing war strategy and access to weaponry with not only President Joe Biden, but also with Dr. Jill Biden. Such a scenario sounds ludicrous today. Yet, that's exactly what happened during the Second World War, the principal focus of this study. Discussing and debating High-stakes problems and questions brought Churchill repeatedly to Washington and made 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue a preferred venue for the statecraft he never tired of conducting. To parley one-on-one with the President of the United States amplified the British Prime Minister's voice on the world stage and elevated his stature on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Churchill's long life, from November 30, 1874, until January 24, 1965, began during the presidency of the 18th Chief Executive, Ulysses S. Grant, and ended with Lyndon B. Johnson, the 36th president in office. 12 Republicans and 6 Democrats were presidents during those 90 years, and he met, knew, or worked with 9 serving or future chief executives. Roosevelt and Eisenhower were, of course, the most significant because their presidencies took place during the nearly 9 years Churchill served as prime minister, from 1940 to 1945, and from 1951 to 1955. The deliberations between Churchill and FDR about World War II remain unique in history. From 1941 until FDR's death on April 12, 1945, the two world leaders were together well over 100 days. The majority of this time was spent at the White House, Roosevelt's palatial country residence in Hyde Park, New York, or Shangri-La, the presidential retreat FDR established in the Catoctin Mountains of Maryland, subsequently christened Camp David by Eisenhower. Between December 22, 1941, and September 19, 1944, Churchill visited the White House 4 times and Hyde Park on 4 other occasions. Both Roosevelt and Eisenhower were accustomed to hosting prominent world figures at the White House. King George VI was an overnight guest in 1939 and in 1957. His daughter, the newly crowned Queen Elizabeth II, followed suit, staying overnight on her first state visit as a monarch. What makes Churchill's sojourns unusual, as well as remarkable, are their duration and occurrence at critical moments in the 20th century. Moreover, his trips to meet with Roosevelt in America took place amid the perils of wartime travel involving hazardous ocean voyages on battleships. It would not be until the early 1960s that government-owned jets allowed foreign leaders to go from place to place more expeditiously. In that era before jet travel, Churchill's visits stand out historically for several reasons, not least of which his resolute and relentless encouragement of, in his famous phrase, a special relationship between the United Kingdom and the United States. In one major speech delivered at Harvard University in 1943, the Prime Minister went so far as to advocate common citizenship for the two countries. What better way to establish and deepen this association than by becoming a frequent front-page visitor at the White House? The initial conferences, with their lively policy sessions and the conviviality of camaraderie, began amid the gloom of war, yet for Churchill, during a season of revivified hope. Arriving at this point required careful maneuvering. Several twists and turns of international politics and diplomacy, featuring 2 of the 20th century's foremost defenders of democracy. When Churchill took up residence in the White House for the first time on December 22, 1941, he no longer felt as though he was alone in defending what he called our island home. For over a year and a half, the United Kingdom's Prime Minister repeatedly appealed to Roosevelt to intervene directly in the war that had already claimed, according to Imperial War Museum statistics, no fewer than 43,500 civilians on British soil. In speech after speech, nearly 150 letters or cables, and many overseas telephone calls, Churchill pleaded, as Zelensky, the closest contemporary analogue to a leader acting in wartime, would do 8 decades later with Biden, for help and greater American involvement. Then, the Japanese assault on Pearl Harbor, a mere 15 days before Churchill arrived in Washington, brought the United States into the war with the power and potential he longed to have at his side. Years later, in the Grand Alliance, Churchill expressed his emotion of greatest joy. "I knew the United States was in the war up to the neck and into the death. So, we had won after all." Victory, so frequently signified by Churchill with an upraised two-finger V gesture, took more than 3 additional years. Yet, by the time he reached Washington, that extraordinary Christmas season of 1941, and even as the nation mourned the loss of some 2,400 Americans at Pearl Harbor, he understood the difference his new partner could make. The short, stocky Churchill and the imposing, when straining to stand, Roosevelt started taking each other's measure long before the Prime Minister's trip across the stormy Atlantic. Not even a year into FDR's first term as president, Churchill had invited Roosevelt's eldest son, James, to Chartwell, his country estate in Kent, and his refuge for writing, painting, and entertaining since 1922. After their dinner in October 1933, the host and his guests played a game that involved going around the table and telling one another the single wish that he or she most wanted fulfilled. Possibly to impress the 25-year-old Roosevelt, Churchill expressed a bald hope, if not an almost impossible dream. "I wish to be Prime Minister and in close and daily communication by telephone with the President of the United States. There is nothing that we could not do if we were together." During the rest of the decade, Churchill's out-of-government wilderness years, he continued to flatter Roosevelt, noting at one point in Collier's, the popular American weekly magazine, "It is certain that Franklin Roosevelt will rank among the greatest of men who have occupied that proud position of president." Was Churchill building up a public figure he hoped, at some point, to work with, or was Britain's highest-paid journalist simply rendering an honest, analytical judgment? It was probably a combination of both, with blandishment almost second nature to him. Throughout the 1930s, Churchill became a loud yet lonely voice decrying the dangers of Nazism and Herr Hitler. His worries and warnings, delivered in print and on the airwaves via American outlets, didn't appreciably decrease the post-World War I appeal of isolationism in the United States, which had been backed by the force of law through the series of neutrality acts passed in the 1930s. Yet, what Churchill was saying found an audience that included a significant and ardent observer: Franklin Delano Roosevelt. On September 3, 1939, following the Nazi invasion of Poland, Britain declared war on Germany, and Churchill was appointed First Lord of the Admiralty, a post he previously held during World War I. 8 days later, the president sent a private letter to a man he'd met only briefly in 1918. "What I want you and the Prime Minister to know is that I shall at all times welcome it if you will keep me in touch personally with anything you want me to know about." It was an extraordinary invitation from a head of state to a cabinet-level official, let alone a cabinet-level official of another country. At all times, in touch personally, anything you want me to know about. In the same letter, which had been addressed to my dear Churchill, the Anglophile president, who wasn't shy in disparaging aspects of Britain's imperial ways that Churchill unfailingly defended, acknowledged that he much enjoyed reading Churchill's multi-volume biography of his ancestor, John Churchill, the first Duke of Marlborough. How many of the million or so words in Marlborough, His Life and Times, Roosevelt actually read is unknown. But a copy of the first volume, published in 1933, was inscribed to the president in phrasing intended to ingratiate. With earnest best wishes for the success of the greatest crusade of modern times. In truth, for both Churchill and Roosevelt, the greatest crusade of modern times was still to come, following two future events. Churchill's appointment as Prime Minister on May 10, 1940, and Roosevelt's request of Congress for a declaration of war on December 8, 1941. Churchill's visits were almost always extended ones. In a way, it was as though Churchill sought to disprove Benjamin Franklin's adage that guests, like fish, smell after 3 days. According to the former White House chief usher J.B. West, a self-effacing Iowan who worked from 1941 until 1969 in the executive mansion, adapting to his guests' lifestyle took time. The staff did have a little difficulty adjusting to Mr. Churchill's way of living. Deliveries by butlers of alcoholic beverages wore a path in the carpet. And then there was the matter of how he dressed, or, more precisely, didn't dress, a subject pursued in the first chapter. Is it any wonder that Eleanor Roosevelt, who disapproved of certain Churchillian habits and points of view, suggested the purchase of Blair House to accommodate foreign dignitaries? In The Hidden White House, journalist and author Robert Clara noted that the First Lady prodded her husband into acquiring an adjacent guest house after she grew sick of Winston Churchill's smoke-filled, booze-soaked stays. The government bought the nearby real estate in 1942, but Churchill, for all his restless nocturnal perambulations, the near-daily routine of inveterate night owl, never did move across Lafayette Square to take up residence in the president's guest house. The First Lady's attempt at expulsion came to naught. Instead, stories proliferated about the Prime Minister's stays. While some are of dubious reliability or impossible verifiability, in many renderings, Churchill becomes amusingly memorable, even strangely mythical. When Biden welcomed UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to the White House on June 8, 2023, the two leaders openly joked about Churchill's bathing habits, his roaming the halls at 3 a.m., and the bother he created for Mrs. Roosevelt. "There's an awful lot of stories that are told," Biden remarked. Sunak, who was staying at Blair House, promised the president he wouldn't intrude on the Bidens in their living quarters or repeat his predecessor's risible rituals. During Churchill's second premiership, from 1951 to 1955, and once afterward, he returned to the White House for meetings and sessions of reminiscence with someone he knew well, Dwight Eisenhower. Preeminent military appointments had sent Eisenhower to London for long periods, beginning in 1942. He and the Prime Minister met frequently before General Ike, as Churchill often referred to him, began his career in politics by winning the 1952 presidential election. Churchill viewed the White House as the summit of the United States, and he wasn't shy in encouraging summits that involved himself. Churchill biographers have portrayed him as a soldier, politician, statesman, journalist, historian, orator, and painter. He should also be considered an angler among the powerful and a fearless adventurer, even a daredevil who insisted on making his personal imprint on world affairs. Before the Big Three of Churchill, Roosevelt, and Joseph Stalin met in late 1943, the British Prime Minister sent a telegram to the Soviet leader that included this sentence: "I have for months past informed you that I will come anywhere, at any time, at any risk for such a meeting." On the day Churchill composed this most secret and personal message, dismissing any risk and flattering a mercurial tyrant, he was home alone and working at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Roosevelt was away, spending a long weekend at Hyde Park. By then, as one longtime White House maid put it, this particular guest acted as if he belonged there. My own fascination with Churchill began at an early age. I remember reading articles by and about him in Life back in the 1950s, when it still circulated in millions of American homes. I watched his highly choreographed funeral in 1965 on a black-and-white Admiral television set and recall being moved by the valedictory Eisenhower delivered during the broadcast. Many of the books published in the months after his death found a home in my already growing collection of volumes about him. A high school graduation gift in 1966 was a first edition of Lord Moran's Churchill, which had come out earlier that year. Several shelves of Churchilliana now occupy a special section in my library. Two teaching assignments in London in 2004 and 2012 allowed for visits to Chartwell, the Imperial War Museums, the British Library, and the National Archives to concentrate on Churchill's life and career. Then, in 2017, a research appointment at the University of Oxford provided the opportunity to explore myriad sources that served as the foundation of this book. Earlier volumes from this pencil considered various aspects of the American presidency. So, you might say, what you're listening to now is the literary marriage of two lifelong obsessions, and a wholly novel perspective on one of history's most fascinating and many-faceted figures. Chapter 1. Alone No More. After battling Atlantic gales and dodging German U-boats for 10 days on the HMS Duke of York, Winston Churchill was eager to reach the White House. His personal physician likened him to a child in his impatience to meet the president. To hasten the journey, the Prime Minister had requested an aircraft from Hampton Roads, Virginia, where the battleship docked, to fly the last 135 miles to Washington, D.C. Churchill concluded his request with a plea to Franklin Roosevelt to please on no account come out to meet me. But the president disregarded the amiable directive, beginning a custom of etiquette he would continue on subsequent visits. Although mobility could prove arduous for FDR, a paraplegic since 1921, he made the physical effort of personally welcoming Churchill and saying farewell to him almost every time he traveled to America between 1941 and 1944. On this maiden visit, which began on the evening of December 22, 1941, 15 days after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, Churchill proposed to stay a week. As it turned out, he would not depart from the White House until January 14, 1942, some 24 days later. There were side trips. First, on Roosevelt's private railroad car to Ottawa for a speech to the Canadian Parliament, as well as a photo shoot with Yusuf Karsh, the renowned Karsh of Ottawa, that produced the often reproduced bulldog-like portrait of Churchill, and later to Pompano Beach for a few days of relaxation in the Florida sunshine. But most of the time he was away from London, Churchill lived and worked at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington. Churchill had first visited the White House almost exactly 41 years earlier. In December 1900, the 26-year-old best-selling author of The Boer War, a chronicle of the former war correspondent's daring escape from a South African prison, had come to the United States on a lecture tour, a lucrative business practice he continued into the mid-1930s, when writing and speaking still provided the bulk of his income. In addition to his transatlantic authorial prominence, Churchill had been elected for the first time to the House of Commons the previous October. For a budding celebrity and politician, visiting Washington was de rigueur, and he worked with Senator Chauncey Depew of New York, who took him to meet a fellow Republican, the recently elected President William McKinley. That occasion, though, prompted little notice. By contrast, Churchill's visit in late 1941 generated massive news coverage across America and the world. Its timing, so soon after the United States entered the war, trained international attention on the two Democratic leaders and what they might discuss. Strategy, tactics, command, recruitment, resources, supplies, transportation. Just about every issue, detail, and design would be on the table. Arcadia, the code name for the bilateral gathering, struck many observers at the time as an ironic appellation because of its suggestion of pastoral placidity and simplicity. Indian Secretary of State Leo Amery, a vocal opponent of German appeasement in the Commons, wrote in his diary on December 27, 1941, "I imagine Winston's going to Washington has put real life into the Americans who badly need screwing up to an offensive policy. Their whole attitude hitherto has been very timid." The coincidence of the conference and the holiday season created an incongruous blend of religious, ritual, and secular stalwartness. Yuletide cheer combined with anxious foreboding. Simultaneous public observance of age-old traditions and the current realities brought the Prime Minister and the President together in the full glare of cameras, symbolically conveying their common cause in defense of Western civilization. In the weeks leading up to the conference, the two leaders emphasized that they were fighting together, side by side. Many isolationists, including the celebrated aviator Charles Lindbergh of the America First Committee, quickly abandoned their anti-war position. People across the United States responded to the unprecedented wartime summitry. According to news reports, parents of two sets of twin boys, one in Alabama and the other in Louisiana, named their newly born sons Winston and Franklin. Some American parents christened their holiday season arrivals Winston. By the time Churchill arrived in Washington, the White House had assumed a war footing. Outside and inside, security took precedence as never before. In Special Agent Frank J. Wilson, the head of the Secret Service from 1936 until 1947, described the rapid expansion of protective measures at the White House. The personnel in charge of presidential security, White House and Metropolitan Police, Secret Service agents, military guards, more than doubled overnight. Sentries carrying machine...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?